The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Emily Keola, and I'm reading Dances with Snogglefanians by Amy Ogden. The Earthman arrived on a holy nine day when the wet winds blew out of the jungle. In the boiling hot breeze from the rocket's engines, the ribbons tied to the spiraling tower of prayer snapped and shook until the ship landed directly atop the tower and crushed it into sacred rubble. The people came slowly down from the shelter of the skinned trees to greet the new arrival, who introduced himself as Steve, or something to that effect. "I've come to protect the planet Snogglefane from the greatest scourge in the galaxy, my own kind. They'll come soon to loot this place of its precious resources, but don't worry. While I'm with you, you have nothing to fear." The elders exchanged glances. Finally, one moved forward, all four arms making the sigil for peace. "Daru al-Aliyip-Minik," the elder said. "Be most welcome here." So the Earthman came down out of his rocket ship to live among the people, and he begged them to teach him their ways. "Only in understanding you," he said solemnly, "and becoming one of you, can I truly protect you." First, they demonstrated for him the mastery of the thorny wind beasts that, generations ago, the people had wrestled into submission. The Earthman soon learned to fly the great crested creatures. Lacking a third set of limbs, he signaled his mount with knees as well as hands and feet. After 3 days had passed, the elders came before him and told him he had already surpassed their boldest youths in the daring and acrobatics of the sky. The Earthman bowed his head in reverence, one hand resting on his wind beast's flank. The wind beast took a nip at his fingers and nearly cost him two. Next, they taught him the ancient combat art of the heroes of the past, the seven sacred ribbons of glory. Though the balance of the advanced forms challenged him, lacking in limbs and tail as he was passing strong and managed well enough if one didn't examine too closely the hind limb position or quantity of ribbon blades he could capably manage at once. After a week of study, the elders ordered him to assume the sigil for wisdom, adjusted his posture slightly, and announced that he had attained the very highest level of the art. To signify this honor, they bestowed upon him a crown of claw fronds, to which he experienced only a mild anaphylactic reaction. Last of all, they made him hew his own weapon from the mightiest Yellowmeg tree in the forest. "I don't understand what he thinks he's doing," murmured one of the new pups as they watched the Earthman sweat and struggle against the ancient wood. "He's going to use a really big stick to defend us against his people's orbital defense platforms?" But the elders hushed the youngling just as the Earthman finally wrested a fearsome spearfruit free from the Yellowmeg's mighty embrace. And then it was time for the Earthman to prove himself worthy to be the champion of the people. "Brave Chris," said the holiest of the elders, "you must look into the shadow in the choking wastes of Namandeep and defeat it." "I thought his name was Steve," muttered a gravid egg-bearer, but no one listened. The elder laid a pair of heavy claws on each of Chris's, or Steve's, shoulders. "Only then can you protect our world." And so the Earthman was adorned with fragrant Ozic vine and beaky flowers by the women of the people, or rather what he assumed were women, as the people had five sexes, none of which corresponded particularly well to human conceptions of female. Armed with his mighty Yellowmeg spear, he ventured down into the wastes, while the people watched from the cliffs above. "What if," a second decade drone whispered, "what if the shadow refuses him?" And they clung to each other, claw to claw, hepatopancreases churning anxiously. But the shadow fell long and dark across the wind-gnawed plain, and it darkened the Earthman's determined features. "Are you worthy?" it rumbled, and the wind screamed in chorus. "I have dominion over the thorny wind beasts of this world," the Earthman cried. "Will you not face me?"
"Are you worthy?"
"I've danced the 7 sacred ribbons."
"Are you worthy?"
"I asked the forest for my weapon, and they answered." The shadow held still. Up above, the people watched in silence. Then, finally, the shadow shivered.
"Yes, I accept this sacrifice."
Brave as a wind beast rider, solemn as a ribbon dancer, stern as the Yellimeg tree, the Earthman did not scream when the shadow consumed him.
"That was," the elders confirmed, "a very positive sign."
When the wastes had drunk deep of the Earthman's blood, and the shadow had stilled in its terrible throes, it raised the swell of its head to the cliffs.
"My people," it said, "I have digested the knowledge, the shape, the essence of this Earthman. Now I can see how you will be safe. I will show you how. Let us begin."
And the shadow reached out to embrace its people. Survey ship BR-23 landed on Snogglethane 4 at 0800 or so on the shipboard clock. When the captain stepped out onto the ramp to look down over the glorious new world that lay before him, he was surprised to find a small crowd of human men staring back up at him.
"Dara uliyip minik," one of the men said, and another elbowed him.
The captain blinked. For a second, he'd thought the guy had 4 arms. Too much space travel on the brain. Spend that long in the void, and it was a near guarantee your first fresh sight of land would play tricks on you.
"Beg your pardon," he said. "I thought this rock was still unclaimed."
"We think you will find our paperwork in order," one of the men said, and held out a tab with the official seal of the Quadrancy on it. Upon the captain's inspection, it proved out to be a genuine writ of colonization, made out to one Chris Stevens, and dated a few weeks before the captain's own permit.
"A blast," said the captain. "Here you are, then, Mr. Stevens."
3 different sets of hands reached out for the writ before 2 quickly retreated. They did look a lot alike. Well, a lot of colonies were started with clone stock anyway. "Best of luck to you. I hope the Snogglethanians didn't give you too much trouble."
"Not at all, sir," said the colonist.
"Chris Stevens, was it? Or Steve Christian?" The captain retreated to the airlock, and survey ship BR-23 blasted off in search of greener pastures.
I'm Kurt Benrood. This is Enumerate by Lawrence Raphael Brothers. The sorcerer stands in the center of a magic circle, a conservative gray business suit showing under his white ritual mantle, the traditional rod of blasting in his hand. I'm off to the side in the triangle of summoning. "Come not in that form, I adjure thee, in the holy name of..." Okay, so maybe the roiling nest of cobras was a bit over the top, but I hate this slow, grainy material world. These sorcerers think we've got nothing better to do than wait on them. "Hold on," I say. "How's this?" Now I'm a rotating polyhedron, Kepler's stella octagula. I didn't mind it when Johannes summoned me. At least he knew his geometry and orbital mechanics. "Not in that form either," says the sorcerer. I'd roll my eyes if I had them.
Maybe if they'd tell me up front what form they wanted, I wouldn't have to go through this every time. I try again.
"Oh my God, that's disgusting. Come not in that form, lest I scourge and blast thee." Blah, blah, blah. Too many eyes, I suppose. I run out an old standard.
"Now that's more like it," says the sorcerer. I'm wearing thigh-high leather boots and a corset. Red skin grading to orange. D-cups. A snaky barbed tail. Kepler liked me this way, too. but we both knew it was a joke. Okay, I lie. I am bound by your power, master. What is your desire? As if. I adjure thee, he says, gesturing with the rod. O great Duke Gremory, give me command of thy legions of spirits. Typical ignorant sorcerer. Doesn't know what he's dealing with, or who, apparently. Gremory, I ask? I'm not Gremory. Why did you think I was? This is your sigil. He picks up a tablet with a complicated engraving and flourishes it in my face. An unfamiliar sigil, not mine. But if he used the wrong sigil and summoned me anyway, then... That's not it, I say. You must have gotten me by accident. Which square did you use? The square of Gremory, of course. He flips the tablet over. For pity's sake, it's not even a magic square. One of the cells is duplicated. There are two eights. How could anyone get that wrong? I shake my head. You know how all this works, right? The numbers in combination with the sigil? Well, obviously not. Another idiot working by rote from a grimoire. I gesture casually to get close to the boundary of the triangle of summoning he's drawn around me. No effect. Naturally, it's meant to confine this Gremory person, not me. I could leave right now, but as long as I'm here anyway... Command me to explain it to you, I say. What? This is dangerous stuff you're playing with, and you are clueless. So come on, I'm volunteering to instruct you. Isn't that what you want? Huh. I even mean it, if he's smart enough to learn anyway. Oh, he says, I command you to instruct me in the principles of the Geisha. Right. Now I'm bound by your adjuration. And the fool steps out of his circle to erase my triangle. If I really was a demon, he'd be in little pieces by now. I materialize a slate and some chalk. Do you know field theory? No? Okay, linear algebra. Surely you know linear algebra, right? Half an hour passes. We haven't even gotten to the determinant of a 2x2 matrix when he yawns. Enough, he says. This is ridiculous. I'm not interested in math. I want power. What can you do for me besides teach me useless stuff like this? I quite agree. Enough is enough. Okay, I say. Here's the deal. Your ritual is bogus. Whoever wrote your grimoire hid the truth in a bunch of magical nonsense. I'm not a demon or a spirit or whatever it is you think you've summoned. He boggles. But I normally exist in the symplectic manifold, a continuum outside of your funny little universe. I'm not a gross material creature like you. You might call me a being of pure mathematics. But if you use the right combination of sigil topology and eigenvectors from the magic square, you can summon and bind people like me to your disgusting quantized space-time. And we really hate that. I can feel myself getting stupider every second I'm here. He blinks. I'm pretty sure he doesn't understand one word in five. But why... Why did I waste all this time trying to teach you something you're too unintelligent to value? Because sometimes one of you wretched little atomic fleshworms somehow manifests enough intelligence to make conversation with you worth being summoned. Pythagoras, Hypatia, Kepler, Cantor, all of them smart and interesting, fun to talk to even. Not you, though. You might have summoned me by a lucky accident, but you sure didn't bind me. He steps back, raises his rod. By tetragrammaton, by anaphexiton, and primacumaton. I told him the ritual was bogus, but if that's what he wants, now I'm 3 meters tall, male, with a goat's head and long curly horns. My body is just a visual illusion, so it takes some pretty fancy computation to come up with a set of force vectors to make it feel like I'm grabbing him and immobilizing his arms in a tight embrace. Extra effort to simulate hot breath in his face. Ah! His eyes roll up in his head and he collapses in a dead faint as I relax my imaginary grip on him. I'm already on my way back to a world that makes sense. When the sorcerer wakes up, he'll find his rod of blasting broken and all the magic squares in his grimoire replaced with Sudoku puzzles. Harsh? Perhaps. But I hate wrong numbers.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading Maestro by Neil A. Klein. Maestro almost got his tail stuck in the door at the Chinese takeout. Of course, a full-grown tiger has to be careful in places like that. Maestro is nearly 10 feet long from nose to tail and weighs a quarter of a ton. Most apex predators don't use carryout. Wild tigers catch their prey and bring it down with bloody claws. Does Maestro ever dream of running deer, of crushing backs and snapping necks? I was thinking about that when we got back to the flat. Would he have ever tasted Kung Pao chicken if we weren't linked? Would he even care? Is his life better or worse with me in it? I know mine is better. I can't remember how I slept without him next to me, listening to his breathing, feeling his warmth, rubbing my face in his fur. I used to sleep with a pistol next to my head. Now I sleep with a tiger. I used to be afraid all the time. Now I'm not afraid of anything. Comfort animals have been around for decades. It's only in the last few years that they've been able to grow the larger wild animals in vitro and modify their behavior. There aren't that many companions yet. It seems humans have an instinctive distrust of creatures that can take their heads off. But really, how far is it from taking a poodle on an airplane to walking in the park with a cheetah? By law, people must accommodate us, but everyone reacts differently. Some people cross the street to avoid us. Some are fascinated and want to touch him or me. Some are horrified, accusing me of violating animal rights. One of those even threatened me until Maestro growled at him and showed a little 4-inch fang. The jerk pissed himself and ran off. I guess he didn't love animals as much as he thought he did. I think we're saving them. Bengals were nearly extinct 50 years ago. Now there are thousands. What difference does it make if mine is a little more civilized? Wild Bengals don't survive very long. Nobody cares for them or mourns when they die. It's so sad. I think it's better to be linked. It's better to have someone. It's better not to be alone. But sometimes I wonder what Maestro thinks.
Kirk Benroot, I'm reading The Cat is a Metaphor by Corey Maloney. So this guy I knew, he broke up with his boyfriend, but they lived together for a while after because they shared a lease, which was basically just as awkward as you'd expect. And they had a cat, this gray tabby missing half of one ear, and both of them refused to feed it on the grounds that it was the other's problem. So they kept living together and fought and exchanged bitchy comments and occasionally had sex when they got drunk and or felt maudlin, and the cat got thinner and thinner, and thinner. Eventually the cat died. Only this was some kind of macabre Schrodinger scenario, in that it was impossible to say exactly when it died, because it kept going like nothing had changed. It still scratched furniture, and meowed, and rubbed up against your leg, except now its claws got stuck in the furniture, and the meowing sounded kind of wet and decaying. and when it rubbed up on you, it left streaks of itself behind and ruined your favorite pair of jeans. Not that I'm still bitter or anything. And in death, as in life, it really liked lazing around in sunbeams, which you can imagine what that did for the smell. Anyway, my friend finally moved out once the lease ran up. I ran into him a few weeks back, and I asked him, whatever happened to the cat? He told me that after a while it got down to a skeleton and would just prance around trying to get their attention. Clack, 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 clack. And they both just tried to ignore it, and each other, until one day at breakfast the cat was dancing across the table and it stopped. And it looked from my friend to his ex and back. And then a minute later it kind of shuddered and collapsed into a little pile of bones. And then the bones turned to dust. And at some point my friend, or his ex, he can't remember which, they swept the dust into the trash. Its animating force diffused, a memory, a whisper, a fading dream.
Emily Keola, and I am reading The Library is Open by Beth Cato. The library was open, all the good that it did. So far, only 3 flies had entered that morning. Shauna knew it was almost pointless for her to unlock the front door and turn the front window sign to open, but she found comfort in the routine, even though she spent most of her time outside. The Teen Readers Club Edible Garden was more lush and more necessary than ever before. Few of the children drop by these days, though. The town only had 1,000 folks to start, and as the weeks had passed, more people had scattered to the winds. Rumors abounded of cities that still had electricity and some semblance of stable infrastructure, and of others where the situation was far, far worse. She had debated making the trek north herself, to her sister's family, but who else would maintain the garden? Who would bring books and fresh produce to the senior apartments down on Brown Street? Shauna liked that she felt needed these days, but maybe her sister needed her too. She tipped her pail to douse the tomato plants with water fetched from the canal. Shoes scuffed on the gravel path behind her. She turned, a hand on the knife kept sheathed at her waist. A man stood there, his tanned skin shiny with sweat. Dirt powdered his clothes brown. He held a backpack with both hands. "I'm sorry, is the library open?" he asked. "I looked inside, but I didn't see anyone." "Yes, it's open. I'm the librarian. Shauna, how can I help you?" She eyed him with blatant suspicion. Not many strangers came around these days. The library was on the far side of town from the highway, which still saw limited traffic, most of it by bicycle or foot. "I came," he said, unzipping the backpack, "to return a book." She dried her hands on her hips as he held out an illustrated hardcover children's book, The Sloth and the Celestial Goldfish. She knew she should be more cautious, but she couldn't help but approach, hands outstretched. "This is one of ours! I remember it!" She had read most of the small library's collections of children's books. Where did you come from? "I lived a few hours north. Well, more than a few hours these days. My children's grandmother lived here in town. Edith Hernandez?" "I knew her! She died back before..." Shauna summed up recent events with a wave of her hand. "Yes. I found this book at my ex-wife's place and thought it was only right to return it." His voice grew husky and he cleared his throat. "Where were the children?" Shauna stroked the slick book cover, suddenly aware that asking about their whereabouts would gut this man faster than the knife sheathed at her side. "Come with me," she said. She guided him inside. The eeriness of the library at this time of day still unsettled her. The clamorous toddler program should be underway on the rug as the Wednesday senior group camped at their usual table near the magazine shelf,
where they groused over crossword clues and compared health woes. The clitter-clack of computer keys should provide a discordant soundtrack. Now, the computer monitor stared outward, blank and black. Shauna had drawn happy faces on the dusty screens a few weeks back, and her finger marks were hard to see now. The accumulation of dust and the dead violets on the counter embarrassed her. This man had come a long way. The library should look better than this. He didn't seem to notice, though. He craned his head and took in everything, a faint smile on his lips. I remember coming here with them once. She hesitated at the doorway to the children's section, belatedly wondering if it would pain him to be there, then walked on. She found the book's home and slid it onto the shelf. I'll record that it's been returned, she said. Can I help you find anything else? An odd sense of normalcy came over her. Uttering those words was as comfortable as slipping into a favorite pair of sweatpants. The few people who came by these days didn't need much assistance. They spoke with her in the garden, then went straight to the do-it-yourself section. Her question stunned him. Check out another book? But I don't know if I'll be back. I don't know if I can come back. I know what we can do. She guided him back to a revolving wire bookcase. These donated paperbacks aren't checked out. People can read them or keep them at their leisure. He reached for a book, his finger stroking the stamped mark across the top pages. You sure? Yearning softened his voice. Of course. Take that one. It just came out in paperback earlier this year. It's good. Lots of action, but hopeful. Hopeful, he murmured as he tucked it into his laden backpack. The small book fit without issue. He straightened, pack slung over his shoulder. I should be headed out. I have a long way to go today. He didn't offer a destination, so Shauna didn't ask. Thanks for coming by. In his absence, all was quiet again but the buzzing of a distant fly. The return to reality left her dazed. She sat at her desk, as if on autopilot, and opened the journal where she now hand-wrote returns. The sloth and the celestial goldfish, returned by Edith Hernandez. That would do. Shauna put down the pencil. She knew she should return to the garden, but she couldn't move quite yet. The library was open, after all. This seat was where she belonged.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.